Hi, I'm Helge Pedersen. Welcome to Ride and Talk with Andy Duke. We are talking about traveling the world and meeting people and cultures on two wheels. I hope you enjoy the show.
Greetings, everyone. Although you may know him from his excellent travel book, 10 Years on Two Wheels, Helge Pedersen has in fact spent most of his adult life exploring the world on BMW GS motorcycles and sharing its wonders with all those who have been lucky enough to join his Globetrotters tours. There are so many cool stories Helge has amassed over the past four decades that we'd need a whole series of podcasts to feature them all, but we've squeezed as many of his experiences as we could into the next hour just for your listening pleasure. So sit back, relax, and let the Norwegian soft voice transport you on a journey through 40 years of GS memories, including that infamous crossing of the Darien Gap. So Helge, welcome to Ride and Talk, on the line all the way from the west coast of the USA. I'm delighted to finally have you as our guest today.
Oh, good to talk to you, Andy.
So when did your love of two wheels begin as a young guy in Norway? Who got you into bikes in the first place?
Oh, it was my father. Like many kids, you know, I think it was their parents that influenced them. And my father, he was a motorcyclist when he was young, until he met my mom and crashed. And then that was the end of that, kind of. But he still had it in his blood. He liked it and he encouraged me.
And you grew up in Kristiansand, which I believe is a port in the south of the country. Is that right?
Yeah, if you look at the length of Norway, at the very bottom of Norway is Kristiansand, and that's my hometown. And I still have my sister and brother living there, and yeah, that's my home.
So did the comings and goings of ships in that town sort of inspire you to think about travel and distant horizons, or was it something or someone else? I read somewhere they used to spend a lot of time looking at National Geographic magazines.
Yeah, it was a combination. I had uncles that was captains on ships, sailed all over the world, and Uncle Svein, which was my favorite guy, he came home and he had all these stories. And you also write about National Geographic, because my father, he got a subscription on National Geographic. And you have to remember, this is a magazine, I don't understand nothing. It's in English. You know, Norway is a little country, they don't translate it. But I could see the pictures, and then my father would read it and translate and tell me the stories. And that was a highlight for me, sitting next to him or when I was little on his lap and seeing all of these stories from all over the world. Still love that magazine. It's good.
Yeah, absolutely. Fantastic pictures, fantastic stories as well. So in your early 20s, you got your first BMW road bike. It was an R100/7, I believe. So what was it that attracted you to the brand way back then? Because it was a nice bike for a young guy to have.
Yeah, it was my friend Per-Ola Bang in Kristiansand that got me into motorcycling. He and his brother, Agnar, and they had motorcycles and I always wanted. So our first bike I got was a Ish 49. It was a Russian bike, then I got the TT500 Suzuki, and then I always dreamt about having a BMW because that was Pelle had, and that's how I got into that bike.
And then a bike was launched that seemed to have been made with your travel ambitions in mind. I mean, I'm wondering whether it was destiny, you know, because tell us the background story about the R80 GS, and I believe you got the second one that was imported into the country, didn't you?
Yes, it was, I think it was destiny, as you say, because I worked on a helicopter service in northern Norway on a Sea King helicopter and as a photographer. And I was on a motorcycle tour down in Europe, and I already planned that I was going to quit my job after my contract was up and I wanted to go traveling. And I was down in Italy, and my friend come up and said, Helge, they just got this new R80 GS. They imported two. I just bought the first one, he said. And I immediately contacted the importer in Norway, in Oslo, and said, hey, put my name on that one. So I traded in my R100/7 for the RATGS. And yeah, it was just perfect because I had one more year to plan my trip and then I headed out.
So you had a plan for a trip and you had your GS, but at the same time you also had this budding career. I mean, you were already working as a photographer. You probably had, you know, quite a well-paid job doing that. So there was a lot at stake, you know, in terms of a safe career path, financial security, all of those things. Did you think about that or were you too much focused on the escape, the great escape?
No, I thought about it a lot, but I think I had it in me, this adventure thing, because I went to school to get my education for the photography thing. And I came out best in class. It was only six of us. And I could kind of probably have gotten a nice job with Kodak in Oslo. And that was the attraction for my schoolmates. But I asked or applied for the job furthest away, up in northern Norway, 70 degrees north, called Laksel. It's 150 kilometers south of North Cape. And that, so it's way on top there.
And so I'm just looking.
Yeah, I can see it behind you there, the map. But that job there just told me I wanted more than this adventure. I had a contract for 3 years and I had to decide to renew it for three more years. And I could easily have done that. But then I said to myself, well, one day I'll probably get a picket fence, 10 kids and the whole enchilada. But let me do something before that. And a friend of mine had traveled to get a job in Tanzania. And he said, why don't you come down and visit? So I thought, yeah, why don't I do that? So I thought, perhaps I could drive down there. I had no clue what I were doing. But that's how it all started. The dream started in that manner.
Yeah, it just takes a spark of an idea, doesn't it? I mean,
yep.
So you had this new GS and you had this itch to get out and ride it, but there was no adventure motorcycling industry to speak of at that time. I mean, there were no aftermarket specialist parts, no official accessories, probably no Touratech. So how did you get this unproven bike prepared for overland travel?
Again, it was my friend, the BMW rider, Pelle, or Per Ole Bang, and we sat down, looked at all kind of magazines. We got German magazine Motorrad and British magazines, Scandinavian magazine, and we read these stories up through the years, and I'd seen that people were doing things, you know, they were making things. And a friend of mine at that time went to study in Germany medicine. He became a doctor later, and he brought back a Heinrich tank, which is a 40 liter tank, big mother. And that's what we put on, because the R80GS was not really a world traveling bike. It was an enduro off-road Geländestraße bike, but with a little modification. And I must say that Pelle, he worked on, you have to remember this is in 1981, he worked on a CAD system on computers. 1981 computers, and he worked for the platforms for the North Sea and stuff to make things there. So he said, okay, I constructed this, we're gonna reinforce the rear subframe of the bike, and I'm imitating that you are flying 10 meters in the air landing, and we are going to make a shock absorber system for these, and they are going to break off when you crash, because he said there has to be a fuse in every system. And he's very, very right about that. I'm not an engineer, but I think everybody understands that something has to give. And he made a system that had to give. That was 10 millimeter bolts that held these panniers. And they broke many times during the trip when I fell. But I had spare 10 millimeter bolts. It took me half an hour to fix it instead of breaking and busting the whole frame and the rest of the bike when I crashed. So that's how we started to build up. So I really have to give him all the credit for that. And it was kind of a funny story too, because he was starting a family. He already had two kids, I think, at the time. And I was camping up at his property in my little green tent, helping building the foundation, concrete work and all kind of stuff. And in the evenings, we went down to his workshop where he worked, and welded and reinforced the bike and built up the bike.
Fantastic to have an engineer like that to really sort of think through all the possibilities about what might happen, what could happen, and then to sort of strengthen the bike accordingly, because, you know, it literally was unproven, as you say. So yeah. What about your own mechanical skills, though? I mean, I know you had the Slash 7 before, but did you know your way around a boxer engine by that time already?
No, it started with that bike, and I slowly learned stuff. From Pelle and from other friends, I went, for example, I was one of those that started the BMW club in Norway, and Norway is a little country, so we are talking just a few guys that came together one day and said, hey, let's start that. And then I was riding up there, I remember, I crashed my bike and had some problems, and, you know, there was another mechanic say, oh, you have to do this and this. Obviously, at that point, you needed to know how to do your points and your valves. That was just a given if you're going to even leave home. So today it's very different. It's actually much easier today. But slowly, I got to learn more and more. And before I took off on my big trip, I asked Erwin Jans in my hometown. He was a BMW fanatic. And he said, hey, Helge, come out this weekend, we're going to take apart the gearbox. And I kind of rolled my eyes. Yes, sure, I'm never going to touch a gearbox. Well, he kind of took me through it, and I learned something, I guess. Lo and behold, a year later, I find myself in the middle of Zaire, which is Congo now, with a gear shifter stuck in second gear. And you get tired of riding in second gear. He cannot get out of there. It was the spring, internal spring, that broken. And I got out my stove, got out the gearbox, heated up the back plate, which he had taught me. So slowly, some of this came back, and I ended up fixing it. And just kind of not a permanent fix, because when I came to South Africa, I got the proper fix done, but it was enough to carry me on further.
Yeah, that's brilliant. That's just to, something that you've learned back home that came in useful, you know, thousands of miles further down the road that you'd have been stuck without it. So absolutely brilliant. Yeah. So when you eventually set off right at the beginning, how much money did you leave home with then?
I have just over $2,000. I think it was $2,300 and change. And my idea was, I went to different magazines, because I had my background as a photographer, and I'd been writing some articles now and then. So I went and said, hey, can you guys sponsor me and take my... And everyone said, that sounds great, just send something, but they couldn't commit with a contract. It was not like I got a paycheck every month. So I started that way, and that's how I got into writing stories and stuff as I were traveling.
Yeah.
And getting money that way. So the $2,300 carried me for 2 years, but I got supplement from the articles I were writing to. Not big money, but enough to feed the gasoline and get new tires and some boxes of sardine and rice on the way.
Yeah, that's what it's all about, isn't it? Keeping the trip going. And I mean, it obviously worked for you, because your pictures and your stories, they were published all over the world. And you know, it was part of the reason that it helped you stay on the road for about 10 years, because I think you rode about 250,000 miles through 77 countries in the end. So I just wanted to ask you, because I think the R80GS that you'd nicknamed Olga, she ended up in the BMW Museum in recognition of your achievement. So tell us the story behind this.
Well, up through the years, when I took off, you know, I was nobody. No, I didn't have a name nowhere except for my family and friends, of course. But when you start writing for magazines, people get to know you, get some kind of recognition. So BMW in Porto in Norway, they agreed to send me some parts. And this kind of happened after Africa. I'd kind of proven I could do 2 years around Africa, come back to Norway, stay over winter, and then I took off again. And then I start to get some sponsorship, and I also, BMW in Germany, I screamed out for help when my front fork broke down in Malawi, and they helped out. And I got to meet a guy called Hans Sauter in BMW Germany. He is now retired. But he was the press guy there, and we worked together on different projects and stuff. And at the end, he said, oh, I would really like to have your bike at the BMW Museum. Can we make? But I have problems convincing the BMW corporate part of it, you know, the whole deal. So can you send me a copy of all your articles? And I said, really? You want all? So it was, I wouldn't say thousands, but there were hundreds and hundreds of articles, and I printed them out and made copies and sent a big box, and immediately called back and said, oh, we have it. I mean, with that volume, that's great, no problem. So in 93, I wrote it down there, and it was quite emotional to say goodbye to Olga, because I think we all, as motorcyclists, even though it's just a lump of electronics, metal, and plastic, you know, put together, but every time I was sick or delayed, she was just sitting there waiting for me to fire her up and go again, you know. And when she broke down, I had to be patient and wait for her too. So it was this relationship there. And they gave me a new 1100 GS, beautiful bike. It had something they called ABS and fuel injection. I was really skeptical about all of that. But it was a good transition. But instead of her sitting in my garage, you know, she could inspire, hopefully, somebody else.
Yeah, I can understand why you did it now. Yeah, absolutely. And you knew where to find her if you needed her as well. And I believe you've been back a few times, so totally understand that. Now, I gather you hadn't planned to write a book about your travels, but that a publisher contacted you. What happened there, Helga?
Well, you know, I'd been writing for 10 years for Scandinavian magazines, one magazine in Norway all the time, so... And that's how I built up, could you say, my name. And I made a living of that. That was great. And I had a lot of pictures, came home and talked to a publisher. And he said, hey, would you like to look at the idea of making a book? And I said, well, I don't know if I can make a book. And then, but then the publisher that was specializing in adventure, they were always about going, the Norwegian, you know, we are big on skiing and stuff, going to the North Pole, to the South Pole, backward, upside down, whatever they do it, you know, all kind of ways of doing it. But they never had anybody with motorcycles. So I thought, well, that could be a good opportunity to promote that sport, because it has a stigma, you know, motorcycle, Hells Angels, and people are a little opposed to the whole idea. So I thought, oh, this is a great idea, because I felt like a cultural ambassador when I were writing my articles. I'm not the one that write all about just the technical this and that. I also like to embed myself and stay with people. Most of the time I travel, I met local peoples, lived with them, put my tent up outside or stayed in their homes. And I just want to tell about how a family in Somalia made their living and how what beautiful people they are, except for what we see on the news, which give a total different view.
Absolutely, so. Yeah. And, you know, as I said, you've 77 countries, 400,000 kilometres, that, you know, we could do a podcast literally about every continent that you've been to and all the countries within that. But the book itself, it was published in what year?
I think it was 93 in Norway, in Norwegian language first. So the publisher, they printed, I think it was 8,000 copies. And Norway is only 5 million people, so that was quite a big run for them. And then I came over to the U.S. I moved to the U.S. in 93 and translated it and did a self-publishing, because everybody here, they wanted to make a paperback. Just, they had a formula for it. So I said, no, I'm a photographer. I'm proud of my photography. I would like to do that. Anyway, so, yeah, 93, it came out first.
Yeah, and it's got one of my, I think, not one of my, but I would say my favourite adventure motorcycling photo, I think, of all time, and it's the one that's on the cover. And I've always wondered exactly what the story is behind this. And for all those who are listening, if you just Google 10 years on two wheels, Helga Pedersen, you will be able to see a cover of this book. And I'll let Helga describe it, because it's a beautiful picture, but there's surely a story behind it too. And I think it involves the Darien Gap.
Yeah, the picture is the bike, Olga, in a dugout canoe in the Darien Gap. Darien Gap is between Panama and Colombia, or I should say Colombia and Panama, because I came from the south. That's the only way north if you want to go by land. But normally people don't go through there. I was just stupid. I had no idea that this was ridiculous to go through there. But I met some journalists in Peru, and sometimes I contact a journalist just because I was a journalist myself, and you get stories and you can trade information. And they say, what are you going to do when you come to Colombia? Well, I'm just going to follow the road north. No, there are no road. Oh, really? So long story short, they told about somebody that gone through with a car. It was the Upton expedition from the US, and they used several years and blah, blah, blah. But so I thought, if they had done it with a car, a bike would have piece of cake. So I come up there, didn't get permission to go in because it was the rainy season, and I had to ask for or have a written permission from Bogota in Colombia. So I applied for it. It would take a month, and by that time the dry season would come around in February. And I traveled around, and one day I was camped outside a hotel because I was saving money. And in the bar in the evening, I met a lovely lady, and she said, oh, you have to meet this guy. He worked for Encounter Overland from Britain, and he take customers on custom tours walking through there. And I think he's coming with a few guys next week or something. Anyway, I came back, met him. We sat down, made a map about it, and I said, yeah, it's going to be tough for you, but you need somebody else to help you, and you need a rope, pulleys. And I was like, wow, this is going to be quite something. And at the same time, another guy came and camped in the back of the hotel, also a backpacker on a low budget, and it was Joachim Quernheim from Germany. He had just been robbed in Venezuela. He had some problems with the Colombian police that extracted some money from him, so he was like kind of fed up. And I said, let's go to the jungle. Why don't you help me through there? It will be fun. And he got fired up about that. He was adventurous, long. And he was really strong, fit guy. So I thought, oh, and he's German. Germans are very stubborn. Norwegian are pretty stubborn, but Germans are very stubborn. So I thought that combination, that team there. And so we used 20 days going to 80 miles, so 120 kilometers or so. And it was the toughest I ever done. But this picture you asked about, so that was part of it. There was a river we went up, and the locals took us there. So when I took the picture, for me, what I see it in, it's going in, what it makes it a good picture as a photographer is going into the unknown. You see the green and going into the black hole of the jungle, so to speak, but it opens up for all kind of avenues. You never know, you know, you set out on an adventure. If you take a right, perhaps you meet your wife. If you take a left, you meet another wife. See what I mean? It's just possibilities everywhere. And there's little girl sleeping there. It's a 9-year-old little girl, one of the Kuna Indians. And Joachim is sitting with his hat on in the front, kind of the explorer looking into the future. So, yeah, that ended up being the picture because of what I just said.
And you were standing in the back of the dugout canoe with the GS sort of laying on its side, balanced, and trying to sort of get all that perspective right and take that picture. I think I saw it. I think it must have been published in Bike Magazine in the UK. I think that was maybe where I first saw the picture, you know, sort of in a full A4 size, maybe one of those magazines. But So just to put this in perspective, because we recently had Dylan Wickrama on the podcast, and of course he was telling us his story of avoiding the Darien Gap by turning his R1150 GS Adventure, Bruce that he called it, into a powered raft, and he headed into the Pacific Ocean to get from Panama to Colombia. But of course you did the opposite. You purposely tried to get your GS through this 120 kilometers, as you say. It's hilly, roadless, swamp, and it's dense jungle. So just put it into perspective. It was just the two of you, you and Joaquim, and this R80 GS. But how much did that bike weigh fully loaded?
Too much. I don't really know how much it weighed. But just to give you some technicals, though, when we came there, many times we took the aluminum panniers off, carried them a kilometer or two, and then dropped them. And at that time, we could also, on the way back, we could clean the track. We had manchetes, these big jungle knives, cutting our way and preparing for the bike. And one of the first days we were there, going up a hill, and I didn't realize that the jungle would be that hilly, but it really is steep hills many places and muddy and stuff. And I was just giving it too much gas, and I got there involuntarily up on a wheelie and totally lost control, threw the bike to one side so it shouldn't crush me. But my hand landed on a rock and it broke the bone up here on top of the hand. I didn't know it was broken at the time, but obviously it hurt pretty bad. And it was a monstrous bike. Plus, it was an air-cooled bike. And that's a disadvantage when you don't have any flow to it. So I ended up getting what they call a vapor lock. I didn't know what it was at the time. But basically, vapor lock is
boiling the gasoline
in the carburetor. It's no fuel injection. So I ended up and thought, oh, shoot, what can we do? We need to cool it down. So I just took out the air filter. And it's not a lot of dust, and it's not too bad. I don't think it really harmed the engine too much. And the other problem was the battery were getting low because I didn't have a lot of high RPM over a consistent period to charge the battery.
Okay, so at least you had a kickstart.
Yeah, so I started using the Kickstarter. And it was a heavy beast, and I had plenty of fuel because I have 40 liters, so we used that for cooking food and stuff too. So, yeah.
God, that's incredible. I was wondering what was actually in your survival kits for this crossing because, obviously you had to carry all of your supplies with you because there's no people and there's no food out there apart from insects and animals, I guess, and the indigenous people that are scattered about.
Well, we didn't see almost 2 weeks, I think, we didn't see anybody else. And you have to remember, this is not a road. It's a man-made trail. So the Indians go there and cut with the manchete only in the dry season, which is 2 months out of the year. The rest of the year is flooded. Danny Liska write a good story in his book about crossing the Darien. He shipped his bike around and walked through, but he did it in the rainy season. Totally crazy. I interviewed him before he passed away many, many years ago, and it was an incredible story he had, and it was just flooding and rivers being dragged down the river, and it's quite an area.
And then, of course, you said you didn't see people for a couple of weeks, but you weren't alone, were you? Because you had plenty of company, like scorpions, giant spiders, mosquitoes, killer bees, I've heard, maybe even, vampire bats, leeches and ticks. Just thinking about these creatures, it makes my skin crawl, Helga, but you were literally having your blood sucked every night, weren't you?
Yeah, the ticks was the worst one. And so Joachim and me, we were sitting, can you imagine, all day we've been working, sweating and just burning fuel like no tomorrow. And we thought we had enough food with us, and we ate it up faster than we thought. And we had to abandon the bike and go to an Indian village to get some food and come back and get it. But at night we will sit and pick off, and I think one night we counted around 156, I think, ticks on Joachim. But then in the morning, in the groin and under your arm where it's warm and soft and stuff, you will find the ones that you missed, and they were full of blood and big. at night, I was sleeping in a hammock, he was sleeping in his tent. You could, if your leg had been outside, you could have been bitten by vampire bats, and they can inject and suck your blood, and they could have rabies, so you had to be careful about that. I took grease on the rope to the hammock, I had some Vaseline and I had some grease I used, because of the ants coming on, and they would bite you. And then the mosquito will bite through your hammock from the bottom. So I put plastic on the bottom there so they couldn't bite through. I had mosquito net over it. But I think the worst was the African killer bees, because they were very territorial. And when they attack, they bite you. You just have to run through the thickest brush you can find so they can't follow you. But when you was quiet and you didn't do anything, they just come and land on you, and as long as you don't panic, they just check you out and they fly away. But immediately when you start cutting brush around where their territory is, they will get after you. So I had nightmares about all of this. We were pretty drained psychologically and physically. So when I come up to Panama, after the 20 days, I had broken some ribs, the hand. But the worst was the ticks, because at night I would scratch involuntarily and I got infected legs. So you can look at your own leg and you see the thickest of your calves, you know, under the knee. It was solid, that thickness all the way down to the foot. So I went to a doctor and he said, yeah, you've broken this and this, you need to take it easy, blah, blah, blah. But the infection is the worst. So I need antibiotic injections for 10 days. So I went to this pharmacy and this big babushka of a lady, you know, she just, normally a nice nurse should massage you a little and then gently inject you. Oh no, she didn't have time for that. I stay in a corner, take my pants halfway down, and she just takes that needle into my buttocks and
straight in there.
Oh gosh, I had a nightmare about her. I still cringe when I think about her. Nice enough woman, but she was just, didn't have time for any pity thing there.
Oh, can I tell you what? Sometimes when you're traveling, you really do feel a long way from home, you know, but I don't think I've ever felt as far from home as you must have felt during some of those moments. But just going back to being inside the jungle at the moment, because you did mention rope and pulleys. I mean, you know, putting the creepy crawlies to one side for a minute, anyone who's had to push a GS uphill in any kind of situation knows how energy sapping a task that is. And you really couldn't ride much because there were no roads. And you said you had to clear your passage with machetes, but this was no flat land, was it? It was hilly terrain, as you say. So how did the two of you manhandle Olga up and over those hills in those conditions? Because I just can't bring myself to imagine how you did that.
Well, sometimes we were able to just push and, you know, walk it and use the clutch and stuff. But there were some hills that were particularly steep. And what we did, we cleaned it as much as we could. I picked up whatever I could of speed and rode for my dear life. And when I knew that, and I didn't want to flip it over again because I already broken the hand, the left one there. And then I just threw down the bike. And that's nice with a boxer because, you know, you just plant it into the ground and it doesn't start sliding back so easy. So imagine that. The front wheel is up, bike is on the side, fine. The first thing I do, turn off the gasoline. So, and I also had a tube on the top so it didn't go out of the top. Then we will secure the top to a tree and get the rope on the rear end. I will go to a smaller tree that was a weaker tree. I climb up and tie a rope to that, take it down to the pulley on the rear of the bike, and then together with the force of the tree that's now being bent over, then you have static force, I guess, going up, but the bike were dug in, so all we need to do was lift the bike up and then the tree start to straighten up, and then we repeat, use the pulley, load up. It's like a bow and arrow kind of a principle. load it up again and lift it around and then secure the back and then get the front up. So it was like zigzagging up the hill. That was the worst of them. It was not many of them, but perhaps half a dozen that it was really. And I have some pictures on my web page. And also if you look on YouTube, there's a video about, you can see some picture about that. It was just drawings on a piece of paper, you know, the map. So I needed to navigate and find out. And only thing we had was a compass, no GPS at that time. This is 1988 we are talking about now. And I was so sick and tired of these up and down, up and down. And there was the same river that we came to. So, and it was not much water. So I said to Joachim, why don't we make the first water-cooled boxer engine? I didn't say it like that, but when looking back at it, it's kind of funny to say that, because we ended up actually driving in the river. Yeah, we got stuck and stuff, but those challenges was less than taking it over the hill. Plus, we had water to cool off ourselves, and the engine ran much cooler too, because it overheated so many times the other time. So going in the river, on the river banks, and in the middle of the river, that helped a lot.
Yeah, unbelievable. That pulley system that you had, I can just imagine this becoming one of the challenges in a future international GS Trophy event. So watch this space. I think we maybe need to draw a few diagrams and get that one worked out. I'm just interested to know, in the middle of the jungle, how did you know when you'd actually left Colombia and crossed into Panama then?
Well, we came to a spot that we knew that we were getting closer to the border, and we had left the bike behind. We were carrying the bags, and we came to a little opening, and it was like on the top of a hill, and there was some rocks, a little platform, and it was a brass bracket, and it said Colombia. It didn't say Panama, but we understood, and I'd heard from the guy from Encounter Overland that have told me, yeah, that is the border when you come there. So that's when we knew it. No people. We hadn't seen people for days, and we wouldn't see people for several days going forward either. But we knew, okay, at least we are going, and I knew with the compass, we are going north, more or less, northwest, I think it was sometime, yeah.
Wow. I'm just wondering how bad the two of you must have smelt when you arrived in civilization, you know, what condition you were in, and I'm wondering what the locals made of you.
Well, when we came to the first village, Opaya, and they saw the motorcycle and everything, you know, there was, everybody went crazy. Yeah, they had seen expeditions go through there before, but, you know, it's nothing that happened every year. You know, it had been a British expedition many, many years ago. The army took some corvettes through there, and then it was the Upton was the latest one. And with Upton was also another R80GS that went through, and that was, it stopped up now, what's his name? Ed Culberson. He wrote a book called Obsession Die Hard, and he had followed the Upton expedition for 3 years to get his bike through there. So that was his struggle. So I think my advantage was stupidity, naivety, and persistence. Because when I came to Colombia, my option was to ship around. It's complicated. It would cost money. Could fly over. Will cost money too. So I thought, and it was all about saving money. And then when I got more into it, you know, it was like, oh, this is a game now. This sounds fun. This is going to be great. But I tell you, if I had known what it were going to be like, I would never do it. I would never do it again. It was one of these things, you hold my beer, watch this, kind of deal. You do it once and never going to do it again.
Yeah, sure. Benefit of hindsight, absolutely. What happened to Joaquin? Did the two of you stay in touch? Do you still hear from him at all? Or?
Yeah, that was funny with him, because he never ridden a motorcycle. He was a backpacker. And when I broke my hand, I wanted to teach him to ride my bike, you know, perhaps he could do it. And the jungle is not the place to learn to ride a big BMW bike. But when and we parted ways in Panama, I stayed longer because I had these broken bones and stuff. So I stayed at Alfred Air Base. It was an American air base, at the Road Knights Motorcycle Club. And he took off. And then, of course, we kept in contact. And he wrote me and said, Helge, I got my motorcycle license. I'm buying a R100 GS. No kidding, I said. Yeah. And he started an outdoor equipment store. And then he came over to Seattle, stayed with me there, and traveled around with his girlfriend. So two times I've seen him over in the U.S. He traveled on a Beamer all over the United States. And he have now two outdoor shops. I visited him in Germany a couple of times. And yeah, it was quite neat. Who would have thought that he would become a motorcyclist after what he went through? Yeah. Thinking he would hate the thing.
Yeah. Well, I guess he can dine out on the story for the rest of his life, though, can't he? So it makes sense in that way. But what or who inspired you then when the trip was over to eventually put down roots in the USA?
Well, it's like everything, you know. It's a lady. So it's kind of a funny story because I've done what I done. We just said no. So I'm still going up Central America, and there was a war in Nicaragua, so a little dodgy come through there. So I kind of headed with action. I needed a little downtime. So I took a right when I come up into Mexico out to the Yucatan Peninsula. I come by Tulum. There were some Maya ruins I want to see there before going up to Cancun and the other ruins. And there was this bike leaning up against the shack, and it was a gravel or sandy road, so I kind of, you know how it is in the sand, if you don't commit, you're not going to make it. So, you know, I had good speed, and I saw it, and I saw this was no Mexican bike. It was a big, it looked like a Moto Guzzi, the cylinders kind of sticking up there, but I couldn't really stop there because I would crash. So I found a place, turned around, come back, and I said, yeah, good time for a lunch break. Here I meet Dana Payne. He was from Seattle on his yearly outing. And this time he chose to ride all the way from Seattle down to the Yucatan Peninsula. And he said, hey, I have a mask and fins. If you want to do some snorkeling, you're welcome. So I ended up staying there, making friends with him. Fast forward, come up to Seattle, and he said, please come and visit me. And by that time, we were good friends, really nice guy. I liked him a lot. So he said, you can stay with me. And I stayed with him. And he worked at Woodland Park Zoo in Seattle. And that's what I met that later became my wife, Karen. And, you know, that's how I sat down and decided to live in Seattle. So in 93, I moved over and I lived here ever since.
Yeah, and you founded Globe Riders, your own adventure travel company. Do you think it's still possible to have an adventure like you had in the 1980s? Is that still possible these days?
You know, I'm 65 now. I'm going to be 66 probably by the time you get this out on the air, but very soon here. And I'm looking at all what's going on, and I see YouTube and people doing things and stuff, and I'm thinking, oh, it's not like when I did it. And I remember when I were a kid, our parents told that about us. Oh, in my time, we did it this way. So I think I'm just going to shut up and accept the way it is. In the way, when I say that in that way, I mean, I have to have respect for the people that are doing it in their way today, because there's not one way that's right and one that's wrong. What I feel, though, is I feel sorry and pity in a way for people that taking off today to see the world, because there's so much pressure. You have to have a Facebook account, a Instagram account, a Twitter account. You have to report all the time. And I even see it on our tours that is very manicured and very structured. But people, they are so busy in the evening writing and updating their social media outlets to be seen. Yeah, that's great for family and stuff, but and sometimes I have pep talks with them and saying, hey, are you really on this tour, or are you just playing a video game and recording and broadcasting to the world what you are? What about just let's go out and drink with the locals, or join a play at the theater or whatever, and be where we are. And sure, you can take pictures and stuff, and I can totally appreciate that. But I think there's a fine line, and it can be a lot of peer pressure for the younger people today to have to overperform almost to get so and so many likes and so many views on your videos and all of that. So it's different, but let me also shoot in there that it's opened up tremendously, because when I traveled through South America, for example, or Africa, I didn't meet anybody. I met less than a handful of other people that was out traveling, and on motorcycles was very, very rare. Today, when we do our tours in South America, we meet dozens of people, and it's so great because they've been encouraged by other people doing it, and also all the investigation you can do on the internet and find out which border is open, where is the road, this and that, and you have all of this information. So that's absolutely the uplift. So yeah, it's different, and it will always be different when your son is going to take off, and when you are old man sitting there with your bourbon and in your rocking chair, he's going to do it totally different than what you did it, Andy. So yeah, it's life.
Yeah, you've got to go with the flow. I mean, but I totally get what you're saying, because how many chances do you just get to disappear and go off grid for a few weeks? And people don't realize that actually that is a real privilege. Just, you can tell all the stories when you get back. You don't have to update it every half an hour or so. So yeah, that's interesting. One of my questions to you was going to be, you know, what advice, if you had to offer one piece of advice to budding adventure travelers, I guess you've probably already answered that by sort of saying, you know, take your time, look, don't document everything, and just be in the moment. But I'll actually ask you, what's the best piece of advice that you've ever received?
Oh, the best one was not have too many plans. And what you just touched on, the best currency you can travel with is time. You can never have too much of that. You can't buy it. You can't borrow it from others. You have what you have. You don't know if you're going to be alive tomorrow. Do the best out of today. So I would say, don't over plan it, and take as much time as you can. When I took off in 1982, people, that was the biggest question I got, and they got mad at me when I couldn't answer it. They said, so how long are you going to be gone? They wanted to see a structure to it. They want to see a start, middle, and an ending to it. And I said, this is the start, and we will see where it takes me. And I was just going to visit my friend in Tanzania. What are we going to? It ended up taking 2 years. So what? And then when I took off again, I didn't see family and friends for 5 years. I was literally physically gone for 5 years. And then a magazine flew me back for 2 months. And then I took off again. So that's another thing. I think that was a mistake from my side. I would recommend not going away for years and years and years. So my advice, again, besides the other one, was take it in small portions, because it's very intense to be on the road. So when you, Andy, went out there for a year, I bet you had so many memories that you needed to process after you come back. I stayed too much on the road. I think it could have been good if I'd had the money and a different structure to my travels to take it in smaller portions. So that would be another advice.
Yeah, it's all about balance, isn't it? Like a lot of things. Now,
yeah.
Since those early days on Olga, you've probably ridden most of the GS model variations over the past 40 years. So how good do you think the latest variations are for adventure touring straight out of the box?
Well, I think I'm opposite to many people's, and some people get mad at me when I put on the RHGS because it's like the trophy you have and take out that. I had my share of problems, and it was ideal machine for that. At that time, it was top of the line. Today, I have 2018 1200 GSA, and I love it. It's gotten better every iteration I got. I was skeptical, like I said, when BMW gave me the 1100 ABS and fuel injection. What the heck is that? And how am I going to deal with it? And it's like all changes in life. You know, you get a new car, you get the new whatever, and it takes a little before you get used to it. And that's the thing, you have to give it a chance. And I've done that. I had every different model up through the years, and I tend to gravitate towards the GSA with the longer range and stuff. and feel comfortable with those bikes. But every time I get a new one and know the water cooled, I just love it.
Yeah. And I hear you've been getting into sidecars also. So what's the story there?
Well, that's the good thing with that water-cooled engine too, because a sidecar is, it's not natural for a bike to have a third wheel on the side and a big bucket dragging around a sack of potato or whatever you have. But I've seen on my trips, and it started with Mike Paul, a good friend of mine, and he has a company, LBS, in Seattle now, working with the LBS in Holland. They make sidecars. He unfortunately lost his left leg on one of our tours in Siberia, a really bad accident. But the guy is a powerhouse. I mean, 2 years later, he was back with the prosthesis and a sidecar doing the same tour. And he's been my inspiration for getting into sidecar. Plus, I've had other people on the tour, like Bill and Marty, two guys traveling on a sidecar, 1200 years. It's so different. First, when I saw it, yeah, I can understand Mike. He couldn't support a solo bike with his leg, so he got a tree. He had a good excuse to it. But then I see other people that really could ride just a solo bike. I thought, so that was my limited way of thinking, and I kind of brushed it off. But then I saw how much fun they had every time they stopped. So here's a good example. Marty and Bill is in front of me. We are going in Iran and traveling to the back country, and people are waving to them, and they see me, they don't even see me, and I'm in front of them. I come there first, they don't look, and then they see the sidecar, and it's like, oh, they are looking and they are waving. And then we stop, and they take some kids in the sidecar, and it's, every time they stop, they have more attention. Not that I need attention every minute of the day, because sometimes it actually can be bothersome to have too much attention. But I think what made motorcycling what it was for me was that I didn't sit in a box. I was exposed to people. And we talk about the bike and this, and now we are talking, like you say, the sidecar. But that's just an introduction, and it's an opening act to talk about culture, politics, to have a cup of tea, share a meal with these people, and that's what traveling about. And I saw that was just magnified so much with sidecar. So I said, well, I'm not getting younger. One day my knees are going to give in, my hip, whatever, and I need a little helping hand here. Why don't I try this? So I can't go wrong. In Washington State, you have to have a license for sidecar. So I got that and got on a bike, and I really liked it. And I got built up a bike that if you go to YouTube, you can see Sidecar Helge Pedersen, you will see it. But we called it Big Red. I took that to South America from Colombia to Tierra del Fuego. Didn't have much experience, but I loved it. It was great. And now, actually, I'm waiting for a new one coming from Germany that the Mobec in Germany is building for me. And I also have a wife that's not very tall, and to sit on the back behind me is not really good. So she loves to sit in the sidecar, and so that's good for her too.
I think the other thing, I mean, certainly from watching a couple of your videos, is obviously there's the new challenge of teaching yourself a whole new riding technique, because don't behave anywhere near the same way as a motorcycle. But there's also the fact that, you know, I saw you riding in snow, saw you riding in really quite tricky conditions where people would be, let's face it, you know, a lot of people would be wobbling around, crashing in all sorts of trouble on two wheels. But just having that third wheel just means you can effectively sit back, enjoy the ride, and have all sorts of fun, maybe even taking pictures and video of those around you getting into all sorts of bother.
Yeah, you talk like a guy that never tried it. Have you tried it?
I've never tried it, no.
It's a lot of work, Andy. It's not, yeah, when you go straight, you can relax, you can take pictures. But immediately, as long as you are in London or in England, I know you would have the sidecar on the left, I have it on the right. But so for me, when I go a right turn, if I go too fast, it will flip over and I would be crushed. So and that's the biggest mistake people do. They think, oh, this is going to be easy. You really have to understand what it's all about. So I highly recommend somebody that's used to two wheels and get a third wheel, do a class, do a safety foundation class here. I'm sure in Britain and Germany, everywhere, they have different classes. So, and the older you get, the more imprinted you are on the two wheels and the principle of that, and it's just going to throw you off so fast, and you can get into deep, deep trouble. But when you start to mastering it, it really is fun, but it's hard work. It really is. I remember in Colombia, there's going down to Medellin. Anyway, there's all these curves, hundreds of curves, and your upper body just really, really feel it after a day. But it is so much fun, though. And I would say that we talked about old bikes and new bikes. Having 125 horsepower, or no, with the 1250, 135 or something, just having that and a water-cooled bike, it's perfect for a sidecar, because you need that extra oomph, you know, you need that extra power to throw it around. And plus you have the water cooling, which is important, I think, with that. And it's just, it's a lot of fun. But I still have a solo bike. I have a 1200 GSA water-cooled bike. I love solo bike riding too. I'm privileged. I'm very lucky to have be able to have two of them.
Yeah, yeah. Now I understand why you've also taken up the sea kayaking, because if it's as much of an upper body workout as you say sidecar riding is, then you need that upper body strength, don't you? So, yeah, interesting. I'll have to give it a go one day for sure. Yeah. Do you think it will also enable you to continue riding for a few more years as opposed to riding a two-wheeler or not?
I would say that, because look at it. My customers, I'm just, these days, the pandemic is going on. I had to cancel 20th anniversary tour, which was really sad, earlier this year. I had 21 people who were going to go from Tokyo to Munich. So I'm sitting at home here and planning the next tour and stuff. We are going to Himalaya, hopefully in September 2021. My customer base is people that are 60, pressing on 70. Some are, I even have up to 78 years old going with it. Some are in remarkable shape, but I see, as you get up into that age, what is the challenge? The challenge is balance and keeping the bike and the strength to holding it up on a sidecar. Yeah, there's strength involved too, but the balance is not so. If you don't have the strength to go, you just slow down and go slower. You are not losing your balance, because that third wheel take care of it. So I was serious when I said that this is perhaps a way for preparing for stretching my ability to travel the world longer. And I'm looking into retiring now. I'm going to do my last tour in 2023. Cape to Cairo will be the last one I do for Globe Riders. And then Lisa and me, we want to start traveling. And people say, well, haven't you traveled enough in your life? Well, I've been taking care of people traveling, and it's been a privilege. It's been great. I feel proud of it, gotten people that never would travel to these countries and doing what they have done without having the possibility to do it with Globe Riders. But it's work. I want to do it together with Lisa and me, and we want to see and have our own dream and bucket list fulfillment. It's a big world out there.
Fantastic. I love the idea that you're going to retire so you can do some traveling. That's absolutely brilliant. Before you do retire in 2023, or whenever you do decide, Helga, I really hope that we get to see you over in Europe at some point soon, because it would be great to see one of those multimedia presentations I've heard so much about. And I don't know, perhaps at BMW Motorrad Days in Berlin in 2021. I'm just putting it out there for people to think about and consider anyway. But where can people find you or contact you for more information about your adventure touring program?
Well, you can go to globeriders.com. It's easy, globe and riding, so globeriders.com. Even if you don't go traveling with me and just want to learn about what we have been doing and see, go, when you go to the webpage at globeriders.com, you go to journals, and we have archived tours all the way back from 2005. So dozens of tours all over the world, and you can read not just my propaganda, but you read stories from each individual. They tell their own stories, their own pictures and stuff, and there are thousands of pictures and stories. So it's a nice little resource among everything else you can find on the internet.
Brilliant. I'll be sure to look those up myself. Helga, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks ever so much for talking to us today, and I really do hope to meet you in person out on the road somewhere soon in the future.
Same to you, Andy. And if you ever come out here, I'm going to introduce you to kayaking. Kayaking is a great sport too. So it was nice talking to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Helga. I really enjoyed this chat. Even though there are about 8,000 kilometers between us. Amazing what technology can do to bridge distances, eh? Not like the old days, of course. But then those days were also pretty special in a different way, according to the stories you shared with us today. Thanks to everyone for listening. And I hope you've enjoyed that hour in Helga's company as much as I have. Take care and stay safe out there. Bye for now.